session number 10602, reel 23.
Describing a weapons training exercise that you had at Woking Barracks. Could you continue your story?
Well, the weapon training, regular soldiers, after taking a weapons training course every year, they have to qualify, the infantryman has to qualify as a first class on one weapon and a second class on the other to receive his service pay. I forget the name of the word now, but anyhow, it's for to prove that the soldier is of that standard with both weapons.
And what weapons were you using?
We fired a Bren gun course with a Lewis gun, which was ridiculous.
Why did you not have a Bren gun?
Never seen one. We'd heard about them, but we hadn't seen them. They were just, as far as we were concerned, paper talk. That was the same with the boys' anti-tank rifle, another weapon that was being propagandized around the news press and what have you. We never saw one.
What did you use instead of that?
Well, on Southern Command exercises, later in the autumn of 1938, I was carrying a piece of wood and iron at the same weight as the boys' anti-tank rifle, and that represented an anti-tank rifle.
What did you feel about that yourself?
Well, it was stupid. Because what can you learn from a piece of just weight? It was weight testing for carrying. The information we had was that these weapons would come through time to the regiment. Well, I was there until the beginning of 39 and I never even saw them, so I didn't know what a Bren gun was or a boy's anti-tank rifle was until I joined was posted to the 6th Battalion late in 1939.
You were explaining that you were asked to use a Lewis gun instead of a Bren gun on this Bren gun training course. Did that actually pose any problems in passing the course?
Oh, yes. I don't think there was I think there was only one man in the whole of the battalion who qualified with the Lewis gun for the Bren gun course. It was ridiculous because a Bren gun target was only 18 inches wide. The Lewis gun target was 6 feet wide and 4 feet high. I'm not quite sure. It was the Bren gun target was always a silhouette target of a human being, normally a male or a German. Usually there were silhouettes of German soldiers. They would be around about 6 feet by 18 inches, and when you compare that to a target 4 feet high to 6 feet wide, you'll understand the problems you have if you were trying to fire a Lewis gun.
Bear in mind, I think earlier you said you had to pass on, was it on two weapons?
Well, you had to pass first class with one weapon and second class with the other weapon to receive your service pay. If you didn't get those qualifications, you lost threepence a day.
So all the men bar one lost threepence a day?
Well, technically, yes. But then someone had the common sense to get onto the CO to say that this was ridiculous, that no one who'd qualified all these years should fail with a new weapon which wasn't there. So none of us lost our pay. If we qualified with the rifle, if we got a first or a second with the rifle, we qualified for our pay, because there was no way you could compare the scoring with a Lewis gun. And when I last fired a Bren gun, or the first time I fired a Bren gun, there were two different weapons. The distribution of a Lewis gun is so wide as compared to the Bren gun. A good Bren gunner can get a close group, which your hand would barely cover, your flat hand would barely cover. But with a Lewis gun, it could be 10 feet or wider. So you can understand the impossible.
Just briefly, could you tell me what sort of camp working was?
I was given to understand it was an old prison. It was one huge block, not unlike the barracks at Fenham, the old barracks at Fenham. There may have been three or four stories. I'm not sure why, but there were at least two stories high, but I think there might have been three. That a high wall around, which gave the impression of being a prison. At the St. John's side, that would be the east side of the wall, there was a little gate where you could go out, which was like a shortcut onto the footpath to take you down to St. John's and into Woking. Out the gate, instead of going right round, you could go out this little back gate, which was near it, behind the cookhouse and the dining rooms. Now, I think just through that spare ground, they built some wooden huts to take the First National Service soldiers who had been trained at the depot. Now, I'm a little vague on this, but I had a feeling that there were some of the First National Soldiers, National Service soldiers, came to Woking.
When did they arrive?
I think they arrived after I went onto a course. I went onto a course around about the 23rd of February 1939.
So you didn't actually meet this new...
I didn't meet them, but I was given to understand later on. I can give a reason for that.
Can I just ask you how many men were stationed at Woking? Was it just the DLI?
Oh, there was only the DLI there. In those particular barracks, the battalion had just come from abroad, and the vast majority of the trained soldiers had gone with the first battalion to China. When the two battalions, one going to China, they pulled the troopship into the Port Sudan. This was in 1937, the end of 37. They took a great number of men and officers, and NCOs too, from the second battalion to bring the 1st Battalion up to Foreign Service establishment. Well, we'd been 1,000 strong, so I would estimate around the 1st Battalion, they took a great number of our men. Well, we came home with only men who had less than, I think it was 3 years service to do, or 2 years service to do. But there was...
And the rest went off to Far East.
To Far East. And... Well, my platoon commander went to the Far East. He died rather young. He was a good lad and all.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Mr. Leward. He took a great interest in rugby.
I remember you saying it in the previous tape.
I think he was the son of the one-time colonel of the regiment. I think when I enlisted, I think General Leward was colonel of the regiment. There was a notice in the drill shed, I think, at Fenham Barracks. And I think this maybe have been a son of his.
So it was a depleted number of men that actually came back from the in the 2nd Battalion to...
We went at very... The battalion at Woking would be woefully a weak battalion. Maybe 300, maybe less, or round about... If I say... I couldn't give you a real number, but about 300... of all ranks there. But you see, what happened again, the rookies who were being trained at the Fenham, as soon as they qualified as trained recruits, they would be posted to the home battalion for training, and then they would be established soldiers to go abroad to replacements again. That was the usual routine.
Did you have any role to play with these new recruits?
No, nothing. I joined into the into the platoon. When I left Mr. Jeffries, I was posted back. I was in the platoon as just the ordinary soldier waiting the end of his time. I had about a year to do. But then, in that period of time, I learnt you could take, I think it's a vocational training course. I think that was the name I was trying to think of before. I think it was a vocational training course you could take for 6 months. And the army would let you do your last 6 months doing that course to prepare you for a civilian job. And around about the 20th of February, 39, there was two of us, two private soldiers, our names was on company orders, for an interview with the company commander. Now, when I spoke to the lad, he said, "I haven't got a clue." He says, "Have you?" I said, "No." I said, "I haven't got a clue what it's all about." So anyhow, we got it dressed in our best service dress or battle dress. I think we still had our service dress then. Maybe battle dress, but it's just vague. And when we went in, we were taken in by the company sergeant major and Major Appleby, the company commander. He said, "If you two lads will re-engage to complete 12 years service, you'll both be full corporals today and you'll be posted to Newcastle as training instructors to the national servicemen which come in," because there was a shortage, as I've said. All our established NCOs were established in the battalion, and the ones that were surplus to the battalion had gone to the 1st Battalion, so there was becoming a shortage of instructors for the national service which was coming into force.
What did you think of this offer?
I turned it down without hesitation. The other lad accepted it. His name was John Diston, a very close friend of mine. I'd been a friend of his, reason being, we were never always in the same company, but we were both Wesleyan Methodists in faith. And whenever we went on church parade, he was usually the old soldier, and he used to march me or one or two more of us to church or to wherever the service had been held. So he was the senior soldier, you know, and the old soldier took over. And you obeyed him as if he was the CO. His authority was as clear as the CO's.
What motives did you have for turning that down? Was that obviously because you were engaged?
I was engaged to be... Well, as I explained before, I had proposed to my young woman, and that was one of the reasons why I enlisted. And I kept my word. I said I would try and get a different job to mining. And when I saw these vocational training courses had come up, I'd applied for one.
Can you tell me a little bit about the course that you applied for?
Yes, I applied for an aircraft fitter improvers course, which I didn't know which centre I would go to if I was given this course. And I got a vacancy, a place at the one at Wadden Training Centre, which was on the bottom side of the old Croydon airfield.
Can you tell me what the course actually consisted of? What did you have to
training you to be a fitter in metal. Our foreman was an ex-Rolls-Royce workman. He was a foreman fitter with Rolls-Royce, and we were given he showed us how to do things with files, axors, other instruments, vernier gauges and what have you. The whole thing that went for precision engineering, really. And if there was something went wrong with any of the machinery, where other men were taking other courses, they would send for the senior improvers to go and see if they could repair the machinery. I was sent on one of those jobs and I succeeded in doing it. And after I'd finished that job, the foreman fitter said, "Well, lad," he said, "you can take work in any aircraft factory."
Did the course end with examinations and a test piece of work?
Yes, you always got a test piece, but I think the recommendation of the foreman was accepted more than the test piece, because some lads, you know, they're not, everybody's not alike. Some, when they have to come to do a test, they get a bit nervous, where they've worked conscientiously, say for the 5 or 6 months there, and they've done marvellous jobs. As soon as it comes to an examination or a test, they seem to fold up. So I think the practical experience was a pass, rather than, you know, if you were a poor worker, you wouldn't get a pass. It was as simple as that.
Did the examinations affect you in that way? Or were you...
No, I just accepted what the job that was there. We were given test to cut, smooth and fit, precision, pieces of metal, maybe a quarter of an inch thick, half an inch thick, or things like that, and you'd have to do it. And you had to use a file. You wouldn't let you use any machine, any modern machines, which were even then. You had to do it with a file. He says, that's the way I was taught as an apprentice. He says, that's the way you do it. And we used to say to him, but there's easier ways than this. He says, there's no easier way than the file. So you had to do it the hard way. There was no easy way. No.
Okay, and whilst you were at Croydon, were you in billets there?
I was in lodgings with an elderly couple. Now, again, I fell in very lucky here, because on the day I reported myself to the training centre, to their office, the reception people said, well, you'll have to find lodgings, mind, and there is a list of people who will take you. They used to have, a list of people. And as I was coming out the office, there was a lad had just qualified and was... He said, oh, he says, I hear you looking for lodgings. I said, yes. I said, he said, come with me. He said, I'll give you the best lodgings in Croydon. He said, there's only another lad there, and he says, he's here at the centre. So you come down, he says, and see it. He says, and I'll guarantee you won't regret it. And I didn't. So I was lucky again. I fell in with an old couple, at least to me, they were elderly. They had a son and a grandson living across the street. Old Harry Greenaway and Mrs. Greenaway. And they were real nice people.
How was this arrangement constructed? Did you have to pay them out of your service pay, or was it paid for you?
It was paid by the government. I don't think I ever gave them any money. It's strange, that. I'm not sure whether the centre sent the money to the Greenaways or whether I paid them. That's strange. I can't remember that.
Whilst you were working at Croydon, did you just work in civilian?
Yes.
Clothes, yeah.
Overalls, you know, boiler suits or overalls of some sort, yes. And you were, except for being still on the Officer IC records roll, as that you were still a regular soldier, you were more or less a civilian. Yes, you acted like a civilian. You were expected, you clocked on at a certain time of the day, you clocked off at a certain time of the day, and the normal procedures would have happened in ordinary place of work. That's the system you're on, not like the bugle calling your reveille and things like that.
Following your qualification for the course, what happened to you after that?
Well, I looked at the list of vacancies which were published in the centre, and I saw one was vacant for Short Brothers Aircraft Factory at Cityway, Rochester. I think that was Cityway, Rochester. Anyhow, it was on the Rochester to... forget the name of the other place. Maidstone Road. Mm. It was on the right-hand side, going out of Rochester. And I reported there, and I was given a job as a... working on the bomb bay fittings.
Now, had you officially left the army at this stage, had you?
Yes, I had left the army then.
Can you tell me of the procedures that you went through to leave the army? What happened?
Well, I just left the Croydon Centre, and they would report to the Officer IC records that I'd left the army, but they would get permission, you see. You know, when you applied for a civilian post to leave the forces, they would just ring up the Officer IC record and say, this man is qualified, and he's leaving to take up employment, and they were never strict, you know, to keep you there for the dead time. If you got a job, they let you go. But you went on Class B Army Reserve, and if the Army wanted you, they could just grab you any moment.
What did you feel about that?
You accepted it. It was part of your life. You'd agreed to that. You'd agreed to 12 years service with one extra if required. That was your attestation paper when you enlisted. And I mean, once you've signed it, you had to desert or buy yourself out. That was a contract.
Were there any payments made to you when you left the army at this stage? Was it just a matter of starting a new job?
No, I didn't get any more money from the army. But once I was released from the army and I went on to Class B Reserve, I would receive a Class B, like a retaining fee, if you like. As you were a Class B soldier, you got a certain sum of money every 3 months. Well, I wasn't out 3 months before I was back in again, so it would go into my credits. You know, they paid you per day. They didn't never paid you by the week or the month or the hour. It was per day. If you work part of a day, you got a full day's pay. But, you know, the rate was very small. But it was like a retaining fee, if you like. Yes.
And would that come through the post, or did you have to pick that up at the post office?
I'm not sure, because I never got a one. You see, when I went back into the army, it was around about 6 weeks after I'd taken work.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the work you had at Shawbrothers? You said you worked on bomb bays.
Yes. Well, at that time, they were just then in the process of making the Stirling bomber, which was used widely during the Second World War. Strangely enough, the first one built was being tried, loaded with sandbags full of sand to equal the weight of the bomb weight it would carry on active service. And it went off the ground all right, it flew all right, but when it landed, the undercarriage collapsed, so they had to find they did beat it. I wasn't there when they did, mind, but they did beat it, because it wouldn't have flown during the Second World War if they hadn't.
Can you tell me, were you working actually within a sort of whole aeroplane fuselage when you were working the bomb?
No, just as there was the various sections, built various sections for the aeroplane. You would never be allowed to go from your section to another section to work, not unless there was a shortage of employees turning in for work. But you would be working on bomb bays, or you'd be working on the fuselage, or you'd be working on the wings. The different parts of the plane was done by different people. And then when the sections or the areas you were working on was completed, they would be taken away. And then you'd start doing the same thing, more or less repetitive work.
What did the bomb bay section consist of?
Like duralumin girders, and then certain sheets of duralumin, which was riveted to it. You would, one man would do the drilling, another man would do the riveting, another man would do the cutting or the squaring off of the sections, which was used.
A small part of the fuselage that you were making, or was it just the bomb doors?
The area which would hold the bombs in eventually. It would be the whole area,
fit inside
the fuselage. You would do one part, but then somebody else would do another part. You know, and the two parts would be riveted together, so that it would make the complete bomb bay for the Stirling bomber. Yes.
How much did you get paid for this job?
Oh, I can't remember that. It was better than army pay, let's put it that way, and better than mining pay when I was in the mines. Oh, I kind of just remember. But I was saving up for when my young lady and I were going to get married in June 1940. That was to give us both a chance to save a little money up and put down for to buy a home. there was any amount of nice semi-detached houses at the other side of the road from the airfield. And as she was, she was working near, as a nursemaid, a nanny, near Canterbury. I just forget the name of the place now. Oh dear. Anyhow, she was working as a nanny, and we weren't too far apart.
You said you were saving up. Were you able to do overtime at Shorts? Was there a lot of work going on there?
All employees at that factory were allowed to do a small amount of overtime. But once you reached that, say, 4 hours a week, you weren't allowed to do any more. But there was an agreement with the union at the time, whatever was the union. I never knew what unions were, really. But I think I joined it, but I'm not sure. But there was an agreement between the workers and the management that everybody would be allowed to do so many hours. That was so everybody would get the same amount of overtime and nobody would be getting more than the others. That was agreed, yes. I can't remember how much. It might have been 4 hours a week. It might have been more, might have been less. But there was an agreed amount of overtime with the management. And I worked that, yes.
And it was a five-day week that you worked, was it?
No. Five and a half.
You worked Saturday mornings as well?
Oh, till 12 o'clock Saturday mornings. Yes.
And how many hours a day would that be?
You would start, I think, at 8 o'clock on a morning. Then you'd have a break for your dinner. I'm not sure it was half hour or an hour. There was a canteen there where you could go and get your meal. And then you paid for your meal, by the way. Then you would finish work. You would have a tea. You could have a cup of tea. You used to bring trolleys around. Trolleys with containers of tea and biscuits or whatever it was. Used to come around about twice a day.
When did work finish in the evening?
I think it would be about 5 o'clock. Half past 4 or 5 o'clock, I wasn't sure. But then if you had overtime, you might work 2 hours and finish at 7, or you might finish at 6, or an hour overtime. Just depending, I think, on the particular area you were working or whether the amount of work had come out or whether they wanted a little more that day.
Was there any shift work there? Was the factory open at night?
I can't recall. I don't think so, but I can't recall. I wouldn't know that for sure. I know I went on a morning and finished in the afternoon or early evening. I was only there 6 weeks, so, you know, I wouldn't have time to turn around. Yes. About 6 weeks.
Okay. You were there for 6 weeks. Can you tell me what happened to end your short career at Short Brothers?
Well, mobilisation came, was broadcast, and when mobilisation was broadcast, you just took your... In your reserve book, in your army release book, there was a... What was it called? A certificate to hand into the railway people, which would give you a single ticket from where you were at right to Newcastle, where your depot was.
And what time was this when you were mobilised?
Oh, sometime in September. I'm not quite sure of the date.
It was after the outbreak of war?
It was before the outbreak. Before the outbreak. I was in Newcastle when, was it Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, announced it on a Sunday. Well, I was at Fenham Barracks then. But I think I'd only got there on the Friday before, because I had to wait for the payments due, to receive the pay so that I could pay the landlady who I was living with, so I could square off everything with her before I could leave. And of course I had to wait of my pay from the firm I was working for.
What was your reaction to being mobilised again? Bearing in mind your future wife was fairly close to where you were working in the south of England there. And then next minute you're up in Newcastle at Fenham Barracks again.
Well,
yeah, there's...